As the threat of war hangs over Kyiv, many people are taking first aid classes, preparing for the worst.
Yes, this is stressing me out. Come on, I have been discussing with my girlfriends. People are really afraid.
But for others, it's nothing to worry about. Also ahead, in Syria, the U.S. killed the head of the Islamic State, but ISIS still has branches in Iraq, Afghanistan, and across Africa.
That doesn't sound like a defeated insurgent group. That sounds like an insurgent group with still a global reach.
I'm Marco Werman, plus China's newest hero, skier Eileen Gu from San Francisco.
For Chinese people, it seems like Gu has it all. She's extremely talented in a sport that China hasn't excelled in the past. She's a model. She has a ton of endorsements.
And now a shiny gold medal. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us today. It's been a week since we learned that the leader of the Islamic State was killed. U.S. Special Forces carried out a raid at his house in northwest Syria. They reportedly had their eyes on him for some time. Now the terror group is effectively leaderless. But does that mean ISIS is defeated? The World's Shirin Jafari begins our coverage.
Abu Ibrahim al-Hashimi al-Qureshi was somewhat of an obscure figure. In his short tenure as the leader of ISIS, he never sent out a video or audio message. In photos, he looks a little scruffy, always with a 5 o'clock shadow. Qureshi was from Iraq. He became the leader of the so-called Islamic State in 2019.
Good morning.
From the White House last week, President Biden described Qureshi's past.
He was the driving force behind the genocide of the Yazidi people in northwestern Iraq in 2014.
In the early morning hours of last Thursday, U.S. Special Forces flew into northwest Syria. This video was posted on social media. The raid took place at a house in the Syrian town of Atme, less than 2 miles from the Turkish border. Witnesses described loud noises, and they said they heard calls ordering people inside the house to surrender. Qureshi was the second leader of ISIS to be killed in a U.S. raid.
Last night, the United States brought the world's number one terrorist leader to justice.
In 2019, President Trump ordered the raid that killed Qureshi's predecessor, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi. Baghdadi was just a few miles from where Qureshi lived in Syria. Colonel Miles Kaggins III was a spokesperson for the Global Coalition to Defeat ISIS in Iraq and Syria from August 2019 to September 2020. He had been on the job for just about 2 months when the operation to kill Baghdadi was carried out. He was in northern Iraq at the time.
Every network was covering the Baghdadi raid wall to wall. And as they covered the Baghdadi raid, they were including footage of when ISIS was tearing across Iraq and Syria.
A few days later, Kaggins met with some local reporters.
And the energy and the questions from the reporters were not just looking for answers. It was expressing on behalf of the community of viewers and listeners that they had the relief and joy that Baghdadi had come to his death.
Iraqis and Syrians have borne the brunt of the atrocities committed by ISIS. The group no longer controls any territory for its so-called caliphate, but Ibrahim al-Marashi, who teaches Middle East history at California State University, San Marcos, says it's too soon to celebrate the defeat of ISIS.
It has branches in Iraq and Syria. It has branches in Afghanistan that conducted a very deadly attack in August. And then it has branches in North Africa, Egypt, Tunisia, Sub-Saharan Africa, Nigeria, Somalia, about maybe 7 affiliates in Africa. That doesn't sound like a defeated insurgent group. That sounds like an insurgent group with still a global reach.
On January 20th, ISIS carried out its biggest and most daring attack in years. It was an attempt to release hundreds of suspected ISIS members from a prison in northeast Syria. The fighting went on for days and ended only after U.S. forces intervened. ISIS currently has between 6,000 and 10,000 fighters across Syria and Iraq. That's according to the United Nations. Ibrahim al-Marashi says the group doesn't have the same strength to capture much territory, so it has reverted back to its early days when it was an underground network.
And just simply enduring and then waiting out the chaos, because the chaos ultimately serves its existence.
As for who the next leader of ISIS might be, Morashi says it's hard to say. He expected Qureshi's appointment because of his previous role as a spokesman for the group.
This time around, the successor is much more opaque.
Morashi says ISIS has a council of men who will likely choose the next leader. Meanwhile, Colonel Miles Kaggins sees the demise of Qureshi with optimism.
But that's tempered optimism because the death of any leader of ISIS or terrorist group is a tactical win. But with each one of these wins, it's not time to spike the football. There's still plenty of work to be done to eliminate ISIS forever.
Experts say long-term development goals for the region, like stability, jobs, and food security, will make it harder for ISIS to recruit and grow. Assassinating another leader of the group, they say, won't mean the end of ISIS. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
For more on the U.S. counterterrorism strategy, we turn now to Spencer Ackerman. For 20 years, he's reported on the so-called Global War on Terror. He's also author of Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. So, Spencer, you've reported on this stuff for two decades. How much do you think the U.S. counterterrorism strategy has actually changed and evolved since 9/11? Has it been in permafrost since the days after 9/11, or is it much different today?
I would say that continuity rather than departure defines the war on terror over 20 years. Most, if not all, of the institutions of the war on terror remain in place. Their authorizations remain in place, ready to be picked up and used and escalated as politicians deem necessary.
From the outside looking in, it does seem like the strategy, whether intentional or not, has been whack-a-mole. Kill the leader of an ISIS or an Al-Qaeda or any other insurgency, and if another one emerges and is influential, kill them next. Am I wrong? And is that a sustainable strategy?
It's a foolish strategy. No other strategy could be more refuted than this one. But manhunting is something that the counterterrorism apparatus is tremendously used to at this point and gears much of its resources and its sort of institutional muscle memory to doing. And for 20 years, there's not really been a concern with how the strategy that the United States has pursued after 9/11 has made all of its counterterrorism problems worse.
So what could an alternative strategy for the U.S. even look like at this point?
The only way to address the sources of the war on terror are to adopt abolition of the war on terror as an explicit American political project. The war on terror has made counterterrorism worse. There is certainly a case in which making the problems of terrorism worse will mean that as you divest yourself of these operations and their authorities, violence will result, because those are essentially the effects of U.S. policy. Like, the U.S. can't unmake ISIS, for instance. It's going to simply remain, and requires ultimately political strategies for extricating the United States and the world from this horrific circumstance.
What forces do you think are keeping the U.S. from a different approach? Is it inertia or something else?
On a surface level, it's always going to be easier to start a war than end one. It's always going to be less controversial to cast a vote for continuing to fund an operation of the war on terror than it is to end it or to defund it. Throughout American history, forever wars are there. America's violent presence overseas and extractive presence overseas is, you know, very fundamental at this point to what the United States of America does and accordingly is.
What effect do you think 20 years of the global war on terror has had on domestic politics in the U.S.? I mean, your book, you argue that it produced Trump. Explain what you mean.
The war on terror essentially had from the start the effect of unleashing and justifying a nativist politics that became the source of a tremendous amount of political fear and repression and became a kind of refining fire to unite and find themselves on the march, a general awaiting an army, and that army was Donald Trump, who was able to argue not only that the war on terror was a failure because it lacked sufficient violence against a sufficiently racialized and otherized enemy, but because the elite forces in both parties had kept up with this delusion and this misadventure. And you could very easily discredit the architects and stewards of the war on terror, many of whom came very quickly to consider Trump and not their own actions to be a unique threat to American democracy.
Spencer Ackerman is author of Reign of Terror, How the 9/11 Era Destabilized America and Produced Trump. Spencer, thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you, Marco.
The Crown Jewels and the Tower of London are quite possibly the most visited objects in England. Have been for a while. Check out this newsreel from 1967.
But millions will pass through them in the future, many from distant lands, to admire the riches, but most of all to experience the sense of history that comes from just being near the regalia of the nation's monarch.
Italy also has crown jewels. You can't see them, though, because they're locked in a bank vault. But that might change. The World's Sarah Birnbaum explains.
Italy got rid of its monarchy in 1946 as punishment for getting too cozy with fascist dictator Benito Mussolini. 3 days later, the king, Umberto II of the House of Savoy, deposited the crown jewels in the Bank of Italy, along with a note saying to be returned to the rightful owner. Then he was sent into exile, along with all his male heirs. Fast forward to 2002. Parliament lets the Savoys back into the country. Now, 20 years later, they're coming for those jewels. Prince Emanuele Filiberto di Savoia represented the family at a mediation session about 2 weeks ago and then gave an impromptu press conference.
Prima rientriamo in possesso dei gioielli, poi vediamo cosa ne fanno.
He says it's been more than 70 years. It's high time the jewels go back to the family. He also says the family doesn't really care about how much the jewels are worth. It's about the sentimental value and the history. FYI, the jewels include about 6,000 diamonds, 2,000 pearls, and are worth around $330 million. Now, I have to pause here to tell you about Prince Emanuele Filiberto di Savoia. He has a side hustle. He owns food trucks in L.A. that sell fresh pasta. People call him the Pasta Prince.
We mainly use Italian pasta recipes that can go from pomodoro.
Thank
pasta
you,
to
Vice Video, for this gem.
To lemon bucatini, to pesto, amatriciana.
Prince Emanuele Filiberto also loves going on reality TV. He won the Italian version of Dancing with the Stars. He also went on a talent show called Amici Celebrities, where he performs these songs in French. And I'm sorry for this.
Formidable, formidable. Tu étais formidable, j'étais formidable. Nous étions formidables.
So while he clearly has a playful side, he's dead serious about the crown jewels. As I was saying, his family wants them back. But the Italian government says no. There's a provision in the Constitution that says all the property that belonged to the monarchy now belongs to the state. But the thing is, the jewels were never confiscated like the rest of the Savoy stuff. And the Savoys are arguing that the jewels were either given to them as gifts or were personal purchases, not official regalia, like the crown jewels in London, for instance. The whole thing now goes before a judge. The family is suing the state for possession. The first hearing is on June 7th. Plenty of time to squeeze in another reality TV performance. Please, 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 please. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
You're listening to The World.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
I'm Marco Werman. You're listening to The World. nearly a week into these Winter Olympics, and we're starting to see the sparkle of some breakout stars in Beijing. At the top of the list, Eileen Gu, the 18-year-old Olympian from the U.S. who is competing for China. On Tuesday, she broke the internet in China when she won her first gold medal in the Big Air ski event, and I do literally mean broke the internet. The Chinese social media site Weibo got overwhelmed with posts and crashed. The World's Rebecca Canther is in Shanghai and has more on the reaction in China to this phenom. Before the Olympics, Rebecca, how well-known was Eileen Gu in China?
Well, here they know her as Gu Eileen. That's her Chinese name. And people really only started to know about her last year. When she announced she was competing for China in 2019, she started to get a lot of attention and people were curious who she is. She started showing up in endorsements, and now she's working with 20 different brands here and is really now the face of Team China. Eileen is not a stranger to China, though. She's been coming here every summer for basketball camp throughout her teens. And I spoke with her basketball coach, Zaron Jovic, who is from Serbia and works in Beijing.
Her success is not accident. She was very diligent in basketball, too. I told her that she could be a very good basketball player, but she said that she preferred to practice skiing and that she has serious ambitions about skiing. And we see now that it was really, really, really good plan.
Wow. So not just on the slope, she's also really good at hoops.
Yeah, she's actually a very good all-around athlete. She's also a cross-country runner as well.
So, Rebecca, why do you think she's captured so many people's attention in China? What is it about Eileen Gu?
Well, she speaks fluent Chinese with a Beijing accent, and people here find that charming. Other foreign-born athletes, including figure skater Zhu Yi, who was also born in the U.S., they've failed that test, and they don't get the same kind of love that Eileen gets. And Marco, for Chinese people, it seems like Gu has it all. She's extremely talented in a sport that China hasn't excelled in the past. She's a model. She has a ton of endorsements. And then, of course, she also has an acceptance letter from Stanford University, which for Chinese parents is like the Holy Grail. So on social media on Tuesday, the talk wasn't just about her win, but also about her mom's parenting style, and even the tutoring center that she went to went viral. And Marco, for a young woman, she's also a bit of a feminist icon. I spoke with Yan Li, who is a student majoring in sports management at a Beijing university.
I actually see the girl power on herself, on her face, and also her confidence. We don't have another one like Gu Eileen.
There's an article going around the Chinese internet about a speech that Gu gave in the U.S. when she was probably around 12 years old about pay equity in women's sports. And that's really a hot topic in China these days.
Let's talk for a minute about Gu's nationality. She was born in the U.S., but has chosen to compete for China. How is this being covered in Chinese media?
So, Marco, first of all, in China, dual citizenship is not allowed. You're either Chinese or you're not. So people are wondering, has she had to make a choice or is she an exception? Whenever she's asked point blank, she says she feels Chinese when she's in China and American when she's in America. So the big question here is, if she is allowed to hold dual citizenship, could that trigger a wider reform in China, especially as Chinese people are traveling more and becoming more international? After Tuesday's win, a reporter asked her how she manages the pressure to please both America and China. Here's what she said.
I'm an 18-year-old girl out here living my best life. Like, I'm having a great time. You know, it doesn't really matter if other people are happy or not.
Marco, her comments got a lot of play in China. She's been saying she wants to be a bridge between the U.S. and China and not political, which is exactly what Beijing has been saying about the games, that they shouldn't be politicized. So people here really like how she handled that question, and they're just happy she's competing for China. I mean, each of the medals she wins goes to China.
Living her best life, and Gu is up for a few more medals. What events should we be looking forward to?
Yeah, she's in two more events next week, the free ski slope style with finals on Monday and the free ski half pipe on Thursday.
I just want to know when she's going to ski into a slam dunk contest. I would pay good money for that. The World's Rebecca Canther in Shanghai speaking with us about how China is celebrating gold medal skier Eileen Gu. Rebecca, thank you.
Thanks, Marco.
Even if you've been watching the Olympics, I'll let you off the hook if you were not paying close attention to the man who came in 22nd in last night's figure skating competition. In this case, 22nd is still remarkable. Donovan Carrillo became the first ever skater from Mexico to qualify for the free skate competition finals. From Mexico City, the world's Latin America correspondent, Jorge Valencia, has more.
By the time Donovan Carrillo hit the ice last night, he was already sort of a national hero. One reason, as you might guess, is that in a country with temperate weather like Mexico, there aren't that many regulation-sized Olympic rinks.
There's only three, one in Monterrey and two in Mexico City.
That's Humberto Contreras. He's a former national champion and now a coach here in Mexico City. He says most Mexican skaters train in recreational rinks inside shopping malls. And, well, the ice just isn't maintained very well.
And when you're struggling with bad ice, you get stuck and you're spinning as fast and it's harder to toe to do the jumps and stuff. So that's the difference.
That's without even mentioning that competitive skaters, including the Olympian Donovan Carrillo, have to share the recreational rinks with dozens of people who are there to have fun and to listen to disco while they're skating.
And you have to get in the middle of people and be like, 1, 2, 3, triple jump, 1, 2, 3, spin. Oh my God, I hit one person. I hit the boards. I hit a family, you know.
Ice skating is a growing but still very small sport here. There are more rinks in the state of Massachusetts than there are in all of Mexico. Donovan Carrillo was born near Guadalajara, but when he was 13, his local ice rink closed, so he had to move 4 hours away with his coach to the city of León. He still trains there at a shopping center. Contreras says that in addition to that, Carrillo also had to defy gender stereotypes as one of the few male figure skaters in the country.
Mexican culture is very much macho culture, that if you're a boy, you're supposed to do soccer or a manly sport, you know what I mean? And if you're a girl, you're supposed to do dancing, ballet, or skating. And that's completely wrong, and he proved everyone wrong.
One of the many young skaters Carrillo has influenced is 18-year-old Andrea Astrain. She usually trains at a shopping mall in Mexico City, taking instructions over a video call from her coach, who lives in the U.S.
Yeah, I literally put my cell phone on the boards and then keep on if it was like a regular lesson.
Astrain is temporarily in Nashville with her coach training for the World Junior Skating Championships next month. She watched Donovan Carrillo last night, and she says she's actually spent time skating with him.
Well, it's like skating with someone that inspires you as soon as he touches the ice, because you can see how passionate he is about everything he does and how much effort he puts into stuff, and I think that's why he succeeds.
After Carrillo got off the ice in Beijing, the Mexican broadcast of the games showed him on a video call with his mom, who was watching from Guadalajara.
Hijo, te amo, hijo.
¿Qué onda? Te amo, nena.
They said they loved each other, and Carrillo's mom told him he was the family's biggest pride. Afterwards, TV analyst Carlos Olavarrieta had this to offer.
Yo lo único que quiero decir es que esto solamente es para animar a la gente.
Olavarrieta said that Carrillo's performance showed Mexicans that anything is possible. For The World, I'm Jorge Valencia in Mexico City.
We'll be right back with more in the next half hour. You're listening to The World. 779. That's how many people donated to The World during the fall fundraising campaign. Those 779 people helped us surpass our goal of $67,000. And we want to thank some of those incredible people right now. Hayat Tazir, Tiffany Tull, Kate Dreyer, Kristen Johnston, Masahiro Miyazaki, Trevor Graham Wilkins, Jim Wu, Brian Adams, John Allison, Vanessa Alvarez. Also, thank you to not only the 779 donors, but to all of our listeners. We couldn't have done this without you. And the winner for Best Documentary Film goes to... Could this be the year an Indian filmmaker finally nabs an Oscar? The film is about a group of rural Indian women who become investigative journalists and hold the powerful to account.
It's really about questioning what exactly counts as news. Who is newsworthy?
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. Large-scale military exercises got underway today in Belarus. Russia has moved 30,000 troops there to take part. That's according to Western officials. The Kremlin has also sent additional warships to the Black Sea. That puts the number of Russian troops deployed near the borders with Ukraine at 100,000 and climbing. The British government says the West could be facing its most dangerous moment in the standoff. The World's Daniel Offman is in the Ukrainian capital, Kyiv, and has been speaking with people about how they're preparing for what may come next.
The message from Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, is straightforward.
take a deep breath and calm down.
І зараз активно нападають не на нашу землю.
Our land is not under attack, Zelensky said late last month. But your nerves are. The president went on to say that the media is exaggerating the threat of war. But just in case, the mayor of Kyiv, Vitaly Klitschko, had a different message.
В даному случаї розроблено чіткий план, дана інформація по бомбоубіжищам.
We have published information about where bomb shelters are located throughout the city. The subway system can also be used as a bomb shelter if, God forbid, there's an invasion.
To get a sense of how people in Kyiv are feeling about all this, I head out with my interpreter, Vladimir. He pulls up a map on his smartphone showing the locations of hundreds of bomb shelters across the city of about 3 million people. That's the doorbell of a building that appears on the map as a bomb shelter, but there's no answer.
Okay, so no luck here. Let's keep going?
Yeah, let's check it out.
At another building, there's a sign outside.
It says Ukrytya. I think it points towards these doors. But at least it says on the building there's Ukrytya, which is shelter.
We meet a middle-aged man who gives his name as Igor.
He says he lives here.
Ah, okay. So you're not aware that there's a bomb shelter in your building?
I don't know where it is. Really, I don't know where it is.
Okay.
We stop by a few more places on the map. Some are locked. One is converted into a cafe. So we head to the Golden Gate subway station in the heart of the city. That's where we meet Tina Shokoplyas. I ask her if she's heard of the mayor's message about the subway system being an option as a bomb shelter.
Yeah, at least like have an idea, like we can use it. But actually, I didn't know that before. I'm not thinking about that ever.
So in general, you're not worried about needing to use a bomb shelter?
Yeah, I'm not worried, really. I'm still trying to not thinking about that. I'm trying to be happy in the moment, you know, because maybe first it's killing me, you know, like, so why I need to waste my nerve system, you know, for worry of something. So if it's happened, okay, then I will figure it out.
I speak with Anya. She's from the suburbs. She says she hasn't heard about the city's bomb shelter campaign.
I'm a pessimist, so if something happens, it happens. But I worry about other people, so they should know about bomb shelters, I guess.
Have you had conversations with people about what to do if something happens?
Me and my family talk about it. So if something like war happens, we go to the west very, very soon, leave our stuff behind because it's dangerous.
On the platform, deep underground, Yeva Karavaeva, who's in her teens, tells me a lot of her friends have already left the country.
Like half of my friends are flying away to Israel or to Poland or to other countries. My family doesn't worry because, first of all, they work in Kyiv, so they have no opportunity to go to another countries. But now we are staying here and we are trying not to worry about war.
But preparing for a possible war is a priority for some Ukrainians.
So we're in the outskirts of Kyiv in a forested area between Kyiv and Kyiv's international airport.
We're here to see something called territorial defense training. These are civilian volunteers learning how to be soldiers. About 150 people are lined up in a frigid open field. Most are wearing camo, helmets, and other military gear.
Слава Україні!
The training day begins in the morning with the national anthem. Volunteers break up into smaller units. They warm up with some stretching.
Правая нога упираем носком в пол. По часовой стрелке. Пошли. Раз, два, три.
Next, everybody gets a firearm. Well, not exactly. They get either replica rifles or wooden cutouts in the shape of rifles. Each officer leads his unit in a skills training session.
Загроза ліворуч.
Загроза ліворуч is turn.
No, загроза ліворуч, danger on your left.
The volunteers are practicing how to move from one firing position to the next. They crawl in the snow, shifting their bodies from left to right. During the break, I speak with one of the instructors. Ivan is 37 years old.
We are happy to like accept anyone who wants to defend the country.
That means men, women, middle class, working class, anyone willing to show up. Ivan says people don't want to fight Russia. but they will if they have to.
You know, I think that that's like natural for people in our country to help protect their land. So not only those who are military staff, they're gonna defend. If there are such people, we need to join, to be organized, to be trained, and we can help if that's needed. That sounds natural for me, at least.
Another volunteer who's in her 30s and gives her name as Maria says she feels the same way.
I hope no, but unfortunately we know the situation with our country. We have 8 years almost of the war, and we can't guarantee that war won't come.
Back in the city, I meet another group of people preparing for the worst case scenario. They're at a CPR and first aid class. There's a jovial atmosphere in the room, with some dark humor too. The instructor tells me these classes are filling up quickly, because people are worried about the standoff with Russia. That's what I hear from Ksenia Kharchenko. She's one of the students in today's first aid class.
Yes, this is stressing me out. Come on. Like, I have been discussing with my, like, girlfriends. They're, like, getting prepared. They also have kids and so on. So, like, people are really afraid. They're, like, packing backpacks and anything.
Ksenia, who's in her late 30s, says she's been through some tough times in Ukraine. Living under constant threat, she says, takes a toll.
What I would say, I'm, like, really angry. We have been, like, living our lives, and why can't I just raise my kid here and having no issues like this? Because it's enough for me, like, personally, to be a working mom and having a 5-year-old kid. And why the hell am I not, like, you know, having a leisure, for example, somewhere with a champagne and my friends right now? Why am I here on this training and on the other training too? We're angry, we're preparing, and we're getting as much as we can.
Getting as much training as possible in case things get worse. When you walk through the streets of Kyiv these days, it doesn't feel like a city on the verge of war. Cafes are open, bars are buzzing, and there's a sense of calm. But beneath that surface, there's also a feeling that things could change for the worst very quickly. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman in Kyiv.
The gap between countries that have COVID vaccines and those that don't has not disappeared. In Thailand, two professors are doing something about that, developing a cheaper and easier-to-make vaccine made from a common plant. The World's Patrick Nguyen visited their lab in Bangkok.
Picture a lab that makes COVID vaccines, and you imagine a high-security facility where everyone has to wear a biohazard suit. I did anyway. But this lab isn't quite like that. All I had to do is take off my shoes, put on some sanitized Crocs, and they let me in. Dr. Suthira Techakunawut is in charge here. She opens the door by scanning her finger. And inside, behind a panel of glass, we see a greenhouse, row after row of little leafy tobacco plants.
So this is a very new plant, just, you know, a young one.
Baby plant.
Yeah, baby plants.
And then in another room, behind a glass wall, I do see people in lab coats. They're synthesizing bacteria. Bacteria that will be infused into the tobacco. Things get a little sciencey here, but basically, the infused tobacco leaves get churned up into a fluid, then purified, and that's the vaccine. Inject it into someone's arm, and if it all works, they would be inoculated against COVID. I assumed at some point scientists here would add bits of dead virus to the mix. But Suthira says no.
There's no, like, we don't have virus here in these facilities. There's no COVID-19 virus here.
Which means they're just manipulating some harmless bacteria so that it transfers DNA into plants, like a genetic code that tells the tobacco, make a protein that's shaped like the spiky coronavirus, a facsimile that can trick humans into making antibodies. Suthira says it could be a game changer.
We heard a lot of, like, it's impossible. You're not going to be able to do that in country like Thailand.
Why tobacco leaves? Well, tobacco leaves are just a delivery system for the spiky COVID doppelganger. Some vaccines use animal cells or eggs. One COVID vaccine, Novavax, uses insects like moths. Dr. Suthira says it's possible to put the vaccine in a banana that you could eat. This tobacco strain just happens to be easy to grow.
It can grow everywhere. It produces a lot of what we call biomass, which is good because it means that you can produce a lot of vaccines afterwards.
This is a cheaper process. You don't need a super high-tech facility that can contain a dangerous live virus. You also don't need expensive bioreactors to produce a zillion animal cells. You mostly just need plants. Plant-based vaccines are proven to work, but they've never really taken off commercially. Kind of like mRNA technology before COVID. Dr. Sutira and her colleague, Dr. Waranyu Puncharan, are both university professors. In 2018, they created a startup called Baya Phytopharm to research plant-based medicine. And then in 2020, Thailand was the first country outside China to detect COVID-19. The two doctors quickly started on a vaccine, knowing it would be tough to compete with Big Pharma.
You know, before COVID-19, we thought that small companies like us are like always going to be slower than Big Pharma.
But in this pandemic, she says, small companies have made huge leaps. This Thai lab tested the plant vaccine on mice, then hamsters, then primates. Then, late last year, they were ready for humans. 50 of them. Sutira worried no one would volunteer. Instead, she got flooded with people who said they wanted to do it for their country.
Doing all this made me have faith in humanity.
I asked her, did you receive your own vaccine? She says no, because she's not an unbiased clinical subject. Sutira says her mother actually wanted to join the trial, but she had to tell her no.
You know, like if your parents really love you and they said, oh, but there's no side effects, but actually there are, right? So that's a conflict of interest.
The human trial did go well. There were some sore arms and a little fatigue. That's about it. Proponents of plant-based vaccines say they usually produce few side effects. As to how well this one actually works, they'll do bigger human trials in the coming months to find out. There is a similar vaccine being developed in Canada that also uses tobacco. It claims to be about 70% effective. Dr. Sutira says the big lesson when it comes to vaccines is that smaller countries like Thailand have to learn to fend for themselves.
It's like a wake-up call for most countries that, oh, like, if we cannot produce it in the country, we have to rely on someone else. Even if we have the money, we cannot buy it.
This Thai vaccine does not have a catchy name yet, but it could be on the market later this year, pending trials. And it does not require refrigeration, which would be vital for getting doses to rural parts of the Southeast Asian tropics. For The World, I'm Patrick Nguyen in Bangkok.
In Afghanistan, the education of women and girls is a mixed picture. In some parts of the country, girls up to the sixth grade are able to attend school. For most older girls and young women, education has been off limits since the Taliban took over in August. But a new report finds that leaders of the Taliban have actually been sending their own daughters to school, and it suggests that attitudes about girls' education may be changing. Kate Clark is co-director of the Afghanistan Analyst Network, which just published the research in Kabul.
It's part of an ongoing research that we've been doing since before the Taliban took power to find out what is life like under the Taliban. We were also asking people about schooling. And then additionally, a young researcher has been talking to Taliban themselves about their own lives and what they're doing with their children. And this is where this extraordinary research came up, that a lot of the Taliban leaders and commanders were either based outside Afghanistan or at least had their families outside Afghanistan. And what we found was that, you know, these leaders, including mid-level commanders, were choosing to send their kids to school, girls and boys, including to university.
How are those attitudes changing in Afghanistan then among the Taliban?
Well, I would say if we look back at the 1990s, and I was in Afghanistan at that point when the Taliban were first in power, they banned all girls' education. They banned all women from going to work apart from women in the health sector. This time round, they haven't done that. They've allowed the primary schools to open for girls. Secondary schools, they're still a bit uneasy about. So about 10 provinces, the secondary schools have opened, either because the local community has absolutely demanded that their girls carry on going to school, or you've got slightly liberal Taliban commander. But you come to somewhere like Kabul, where the Taliban rules on older girls' education, that is that the girls and boys have to be segregated and only women teachers should teach girls. Some schools have those already in place, but they haven't opened. So it's a very mixed picture. And of course, for the girls themselves sitting at home all autumn wondering, my God, is this the end of my you know, aspirations for a better life. It's been absolute hell. And all eyes now are on the new school year, which is in Afghanistan, is on the 21st of March. The Taliban have promised that schools will open. We'll see if that happens.
Have you heard any reaction, Kate, from people in places like Kabul as to what looks like hypocrisy by the Taliban regarding education?
I don't think it looks quite like hypocrisy at this point. I think if the secondary schools don't open, it will become increasingly difficult to justify keeping other girls out of school when you're sending your own daughters to school. But for the moment, the Taliban are a really mixed bunch. You've still got a lot of members who come from parts of Afghanistan where women don't go out much. They're not used to seeing barefaced teenage girls walking to school. It's really shocking for them. For those Taliban, those girls should be getting ready to be married, not going to school. That would be their view.
Kate, you sounded optimistic that more changes in attitudes are coming regarding education for girls especially. Largely, though, the Taliban, would you say, they remain a very conservative group?
Absolutely, yes. But when faced with very, very strong demand, they've had to change their policies. What we saw in the first years of the insurgency, it was in their official code of conduct to burn down state schools and to kill teachers if they didn't repent. And they were forced to change those rules because they came up against this desire in many communities for the schools to stay open. So they actually changed their policy and they started cooperating with the Ministry of Education. I think there's actually an ineluctable sea change going on in Afghanistan that the Taliban won't be able to resist. I think people are very fearful of the Taliban, but they also, there's this real deep desire to get your kids educated. How that plays out, if the Taliban don't open the schools, will be something to watch.
Kate Clark is co-director of the Afghanistan Analyst Network in Kabul. She joined us from London. Kate, thank you very much for speaking with us.
A pleasure.
A film about India made by Indian filmmakers has never received an Academy Award. A new documentary could change that. This week, Writing with Fire became India's first feature documentary to be nominated for an Oscar. The film follows a group of newly literate rural women. Some have never used a cell phone before. Then they begin to work as investigative journalists. Rintu Thomas directed the film along with her husband, Sushmit Ghosh. Rintu, first off, tell us about the women who are front and center in your documentary. Who are they and what have they created with this newspaper, Kabaleria?
The women come from the community that is known as Dalit. And the Dalit community have been historically called, you know, the untouchable community. Thankfully, we have gotten ourselves rid of that terminology. But women who have been historically invisibilized by every possible power structure. And 19 years back, they decided to create a newspaper, called it Khabar Leheria, which translates as waves of news. And when we met them, they were at an interesting cusp in time, moving from print to digital. So women from the rural heartlands of India, self-taught, most of whom had never touched a smartphone.
I mean, the word untouchable is gone, but the caste system in India is still very much there. One of the women says where she lived, a Dalit female journalist was simply unimaginable. It's a question with a complex answer, I know, but how is caste discrimination still possible when national policy in India doesn't support it?
Just the way race still exists as a segregator in the United States, I think when societies have lived alongside each other and yet practiced active discrimination, it becomes a part of your social fiber. It benefits those in power to keep a community away from access to justice, access to equity.
I'd like us to hear from one of the main characters, a journalist named Mira, in action. She goes to a police station to find out why a rape has not been investigated. So tell us about this scene and who she's talking to.
She had just come off the back of interviewing a survivor who's been assaulted many, many times, and the police refuses to register the case. So the natural thing for Mira is to walk up to the officer and say, why is this case not being registered? And he's completely taken aback and confused by the directness of the woman journalist sitting in front of her, because in that region, journalists are usually, you know, dominant caste men. So he's A, stumped by the person across the table, and then with the camera rolling, is unable to process how to get out of it.
How extraordinary is this, Rintu, for a woman of her social status to walk into a police station and demand to know why a local rape is not being investigated?
It's revolutionary. It's never happened before. This region has not seen women journalists as reporters. Mostly the mainstream media outlets that operate out of the region have women journalists in softer beats like entertainment or fashion or food. But crime, corruption, politics, the acumen needed in that usually is not considered the forte of women. And then you add a layer of caste where Dalit women are at the bottommost layer of the pyramid. They're completely invisible from a profession like journalism. So she's actually doing something that has not been done before.
So these women are exposing rapists. We watch them challenge a local mafia at the scene of a mining accident. They demand answers from Islamophobic political candidates running for the dominant party, the BJP. These women take great personal risks, it seems, as journalists. And you conclude the film noting that India is one of the most deadly places in the world for journalists of any gender to operate. How much are they focused, these women, on their safety?
The very fact that Dalit women are stepping out of their homes to really ask the right questions to people in positions of power is heaving with risk. And so they understand very, very intimately the social, political lay of the land. They know where is it that they can create allies and how to gracefully agree to disagree with men in positions of power, and just generally, you know, bring the word grace into the profession, bring the word compassion into the profession. So these are extremely fractured times, and things seem to be quite extreme everywhere in the world. But for Dalit women, it has always been like that. They've always been systems of power that have oppressed them. So I think somewhere they have really found a smart and an intelligent way to create an alternative structure of power. And that's what Writing with Fire is about.
I was really struck as to the clarity of the women's discovery of what journalism means. I mean, Mira says it so clearly at the beginning of the film. I believe journalism is the essence of democracy, and journalists must use his power responsibly. Otherwise, the media will become like any other business. I mean, she takes her role very seriously. It seems there are lessons in your film for journalists in many parts of the globe.
Here's a woman who was married at the age of 14, had two kids before she turned 20, insisted on continuing her education even after she got married and became a mother, chose journalism, a profession that nobody in her entire family tree would have dared to, is committed to growing an organization that is led by women, and is really keen to understand her role in this larger scheme of injustice and inequity that dictates her life and the lives of many, many women and men in this country. And I think we all in our societies have those Miras who have everything going against them, yet believe in the power of hope, in the power of showing up every day because you are somebody's voice. And if I don't show up to report this story tomorrow, nobody else will. And that's what really drives each one of them. And I think that is the biggest lesson as journalists, as artists, that we can all take, that our voice matters, but who are we really using it for?
It is so hard to know future plans in the pandemic, but will you be at the Oscars, and will you be with any of the women from Caballeria?
We hope to be at the Oscars. We have our invite already. It is the dream, ultimate dream, to walk the world red carpet with Meera, Sunita and Shyamkali. So we're just working out the mechanics of it. Fingers crossed, we'll be there.
Rintu Thomas is one of the directors of Writing with Fire, India's first feature documentary to be nominated for an Academy Award about the Dalit women running a small but powerful online newspaper, Caballeria. Very powerful film. Good luck, Rintu. I hope your dreams come true.
Thank you so much. Lovely talking to you.
Weddings in India are often known for going over the top on the glitz and glamour. The World's Chavi Sachdev has been reporting on the weddings with hundreds of guests, modest gatherings by Indian standards, and how they're taking a hit during the pandemic. If you want more of the elaborate celebrations, come to our Instagram with wedding party pics galore. Check them out at theworld.org/Instagram. That is where we leave things today. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and we'll see you again tomorrow.